That's the Mingus Big Band, keeping the exquisite compositions of Charlie Mingus alive with his signature Haitian fight song. That's from the Blues and Politics album, released in 1999. Considered one of the most influential figures in jazz, Mingus, who excelled at the double bass, continued composing throughout his battle with ALS, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, from which he died in 1979 at the age of 56. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Wednesday, June the 25th. And today we are going behind the revisionist history that we've recently been subjected to in a case called, or at least it has been called, the case of the Central Park Five. Well, there's a little problem there mathematically. It is actually the Central Park Seven, but we will get to that in the course of our discussion today. I could think of no better person to give us this behind the headlines analysis of this case and the significance of this case than attorney Alton Maddox. He will be with us in this program. You may know by now that pending the okay from the city controller and a federal judge, the city of New York has agreed to pay $40 million to five men railroaded into convictions and prison terms of between 7 and 13 years as wilding teenagers that prosecutors had charged with raping and almost beating to death Tricia Mailey, a woman who went jogging in Central Park on April the 19th, 1989. Settlement of the controversial case is meant by Mayor Bill de Blasio to signal to communities of color, especially, that City Hall is addressing their cries for justice in this case in particular, and their long-held legitimate complaints about pervasive abuses in the criminal justice system in general. But our guest today cautions that the settlement is not likely to change a deeply entrenched system of police, prosecutorial, and judicial misconduct and corruption that feed and fill New York's jails and prisons. Noted attorney at war, as he's lovingly called by the community, Alton Maddox Jr., represented Michael Briscoe, as usual, pro bono, which is basically the story of Alton Maddox's professional life. Briscoe was the only defendant to escape the predetermined outcome of this sham trial. Today, Alton will be talking about the political, legal, and historical significance of this case, the conspiracy to deny justice, the targeting of African-American lawyers in this case, and the stark differences in treatment that this case received compared to the kidnapping, rape, and assault of Tawana Brawley in Wappingers Falls, New York, just 2 years earlier. And yes, it is the case of the Central Park Seven, not the Central Park Five, as you would learn. But let me pause here and do some modicum of justice to our guest. Alton Maddox's deep roots in political activism and advocacy have bolstered his more than four decades as a self-appointed people's attorney general, if you will, litigating almost always pro bono some of the most contentious cases involving official and prosecutorial misconduct in New York history. His spectacular courtroom victories, and I can attest to that because I covered several of his cases, and that is a word that does not at all shortchange what happens in a courtroom when he's in it, but his spectacular victories over formidable prosecutors and law enforcement agencies have set many, many legal precedents, but they also have made him a target of precedent-setting retribution. For refusing to violate attorney-client privilege in the Tawana Brawley case by turning over all of his files to the state as was demanded, Maddox, with no formal charges against him, no blemish on his record, was indefinitely suspended from the practice of law in 1980, not by a court of law, not by a lawyer's disciplinary committee, but inexplicably by an act of the New York State Legislature. He is the only attorney in the history of the United States to have been barred from the practice of law by legislative fiat. And obviously, he maintains the battle. It continues, and the community is strongly behind him. But, Alton, it is always a pleasure to have you in our midst, to have the benefit of, pardon the pun, but your counsel in these matters. And I welcome you to Lead Stories today.
Thank you for the invitation, Eutrice. This is actually a very significant and historical moment for many reasons. As it would happen, the announcement that I have to make will be done on your program, and it will be explained further at the Harlem Public Library, 124th Street, between Malcolm X and 5th, tomorrow evening. That's Thursday evening. I think the program starts at 4:30. And, you know, there's been obviously a lot of developments, and I want to stress that what I am about to announce is not something that I particularly have a real interest in doing, because I'm really working against the odds in making this announcement. But I want people to, you know, listen very carefully and understand what I am actually saying. You know, Tawana Brawley was involved in a legal proceeding or a kangaroo proceeding in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And last year, we had to go down there, and a lot of shenanigans happened. I won't go into none of those now. I've covered some of that in the past. But the bottom line is that the other side did not have to show up. They did not make any arguments. They did not produce any legal documents other than the fact that Stephen Pagano simply said, "I want a piece of her hide every time she get a paycheck." And so with that, in June of 2013, actually, she was fired before we even got to court. So there was a total loss of income even before the court decided that he could get part of her wages every 2 weeks of how often she is being paid. And so we left there recognizing that, you know, when a party does not show up in court, it's actually they default. And there was never any explanation as to why Pagonis or his attorneys did not show up. And so we took it upon ourselves, however, to go up to Norfolk, Virginia, which is some distance from Surrey, Virginia, where the court is located, and actually serves the actual court record, because usually in a full faith and credit clause proceeding, it is necessary for the court to have the entire record. And this court was about to move forward without having a record at all, other than Pagano simply saying that, you know, this is a fugitive slave, and I want to follow the procedures of the Fugitive Slave Act, which basically means that is a piece of my property, and I have a right to its return. And so, given that, at some point after that, the court went ahead and granted his application And I think there was $3,000 plus that the court had in its jurisdiction, and it allowed Pagonis to have that money. And so ever since then, after she got fired herself and Glenda Brawley got fired, they've had no income. And so this is a little bit over a year now that, you know, they've been trying to survive like this. And obviously the only real help that has come forward, basically me trying to put together a few pennies every so often, you know, to try to dent the blow for what has happened in Surry County, Virginia. And so the bottom line is that what I will be announcing tomorrow night in detail, where people can understand this quite well, is that even though I personally do not want to go back into the practice of law, for the simple reason that you have to have real support when you're trying these kinds of cases. And I suppose over about 20 years, I had just literally run out of gas because there was no real support that I thought was necessary to mount the kind of defense to overcome the offenses that these various perpetrators are initiating. And so as a result of that, I've been pretty much, you know, recognizing that there's been a lot of legal blunders, as I stated earlier. I've never been disbarred. I've never been suspended. I've just simply been banned from the court of law, and everybody got to understand that. You know, I'm not subject to what lawyers normally do. I don't have a client who complained that I stole some money. I don't have a criminal conviction from some other type of proceeding. I've never been held in contempt of court. I've done none of that, so I have a completely unblemished record. But you know, it gets to the point where you can't find other lawyers to deal with this situation. You have a young woman with a child who would never be able to practice her craft again because Pagonis is simply out there, and you have a community of lawyers that are afraid to say anything. And so I am, and I'll set the timetable tomorrow, tomorrow night, I am getting ready to start practicing law again. And I don't mean waiting for reinstatement. I don't mean, you know, getting some approval. I'm simply saying that I will be announcing a date when I actually start practicing law again. You know, and so obviously, that are going to take in consideration the fact that I'm going to have to go back and get an office again, that I'm going to have to go back and hire personnel, get a law library and all of that, which I really wanted to avoid. But I simply cannot believe that in our community, our women can be raped, and nobody say a word, including leading blacks, black elected officials, and any other person of that stripe, including lawyers. And so it's just embarrassing to me. And so, like I said before, I will be at the Harlem Public Library tomorrow night to give the details. I want everybody to clearly understand what those details are. And that really, the reason why I have not really mounted a strenuous, offense against New York, other than just being a perfunctory, in perfunctory motion, is simply because I just really had ran out of everything. I ran out of gas. I ran out of resources. You know, I ran out of support. I ran out of everything. So, you know, I had no other choice than to spend the 24 years on the sidelines. But it is clear that white supremacy never takes a vacation. It is always at war. It is always harming somebody and messing up somebody's life. And so as a result of that, again, as I said before, I'm not in any kind of real inclination to practice law again, but I don't see any other alternative but for me to simply get back in the courtroom and begin to practice. And I say that because I want everybody to understand, I have never been suspended, I've never been disciplined, and I've never been barred from the practice of law. And the only reason why I have just allowed this to go on for a certain period of time is because I just ran out of everything. But there's no way in the world that New York can tell me that I can't be in a courtroom, and I will certainly be in one very soon.
Well, that is the best news I've heard in a long, long time. And as you know, I've been talking about the tremendous loss that it has been that you have not been at the job that you assigned yourself so many years ago, which is as the chief litigant in behalf of these incredible cases that that suggest, you know, the cases you've done. On the one hand, you could say these are cases pertaining to individuals, but it's always, almost always about the systemic problems that these cases afford the ability to tackle. So this is great news, Alton.
Well, but like I said before, I just have to get going, you Trees. I don't have another choice.
I know. I'm very, very happy to hear this, and I'm thankful that you announced it here. This is quite a surprise, but it's great, great news, and I know that the community will receive it in that spirit, and hopefully they will also do the other part of their job, which is to support those who are like you, who have a history of being organic to the struggles of these communities. So
thank you.
Let's tackle this mathematical issue here. We hear about the Central Park Five. You have reason to say that there is a mathematical error.
Well, and I think that's really the starting point here. And I think we can look at it from different sides, but all come up to the same answer. If you look at it from the point of view of the man that was arrested and then falsely accused, maliciously prosecuted, and wrongfully convicted, you have to be at the moment when you was at the arraignment. I mean, if you were not at the arraignment itself, then you have nothing to say about how many people were actually in court on that particular day. I was in court on that particular day. Most of the people that are running their mouth were not in court on that day. And so when I got there, as I've said on other occasions, there were seven young men who were called up to the bench. And in addition to that, there was one young man who was there, and the court informed him, because otherwise he would have been the eighth young man, they informed him that he had not been indicted and that he could go home, but that the other seven had been indicted. And so, therefore, you start off with seven false charges against seven people. I mean, just right from the beginning. And, you know, the New York Times showed a picture of me and all of the lawyers and defendants in a courtroom one day. That was in a pretrial proceeding. There were seven lawyers in there and seven defendants. I mean, we're not talking about five. And so, you know, it went on. So my point is, and I try to tell this to the community, if we can't even protect our own history, you know, and what really happened, then we're in real bad shape. In terms of what we can do as a people, because the facts are right there. I mean, I'm not making them up. You know, and what I would suggest to people is that you go down to Manhattan Supreme Court if you don't believe any of this and ask them to see the notices of appearances by the lawyers, because you have to file a notice of appearance when you get ready to start the process. There are seven notices of appearance there, and there were seven persons involved in proceedings after the arraignment, which amounts to malicious prosecution. And so, and there were six people who were wrongfully convicted, five of them by trial and one by a plea. So I don't know where you get five out of all of that.
Well, this is a very interesting question, because when you start out with the idea that, well, that it only is about the five who were convicted by trial, then what does that say about the other two? And what obligation, therefore, is owed them?
Okay, well, this is what it says. First of all, this settlement has to be done by the controller's office. You know, so, you know, basically the controller is the one who deals with money issues affecting the city. And the controller, I can tell you how accounting works. That's why I wrote an article on accounting. So, you know, black people can begin to understand things beyond, you know, what they hear. When you are dealing with accounting, you are dealing with transactions. That's what accounting is, documenting financial transactions. And so when the controller's office got wind of all of this, what they did, they set up seven accounts for false arrests. They then set up seven additional accounts for malicious prosecutions, and then they set up six accounts for wrongful convictions. I mean, so, you know, this is how accounting works. You got to document the transaction. That's what, you know, what I feel about things, you treat, or what you feel about things is not the way the business works. That, you know, black people have to understand and get into the 21st century and understand that you have to deal with business principles. And this is a business that the controllers is running, and that they have to set up accounting systems in order to document what has happened. And so anybody in accounting, anybody who understands accounting, you know, recognize this, and they recognize all of these various accounts exist. And so that's the reason why, you know, the only person, the only people who are the beneficiaries of us staying Central Park 5 is the city of New York. Because now what you have done, you have reduced the financial liability of the city from 7 to 5. And so, therefore, you basically had a tremendous savings on the backs of these young people. And, you know, and when you really look at it, I mean, to be very honest with you, if I had been representing these young men myself, and, you know, seemingly I would be the one to represent them because the rest of these lawyers didn't show up at all. So if I had been actually representing them myself, what I would have done is initiate a class action lawsuit. And I would inform the court that there was a various class of young men, many of whom are unknown, but they should be given an opportunity to come forward and say that they were also victims, and that we would then begin to determine exactly how many young men were actually falsely arrested. You know, we know that they may not have been falsely, maliciously prosecuted. We know they may have not been wrongfully convicted, but the class action will entertain those young men who were falsely arrested. So, you know, then that will give you a more accurate account of exactly what the damage had actually been done by the city of New York.
It is interesting that your client, the one that you represented, was the only one to walk out of there, basically vanquishing the intent to convict and incarcerate him. How did that happen, and why didn't it happen to the others?
Well, you know, what had happened, well, I think the first thing you have to do when you practice law, you know, I can't tell a lawyer how to do that craft. But the first thing that I think any conscientious lawyer should do is to look at the facts, observe everything that has happened, and then come up with a particular legal strategy, how to deal with that. And so, you know, basically, when we talk about the Central Park 7, you got to realize I actually went down to Scottsboro, Alabama. See, you know, I'm the only one that went down there. I'm sure I haven't heard no other lawyers say they went. I went down to Scottsboro, Alabama, went to the actual courthouse where the Scottsboro boys were convicted. And I studied the proceedings of what happened with them because all of these cases have some real significance. You know, you can't just hear about some cases and then don't react to what may have some meaning with those particular cases. So I went down to Scottsboro, Alabama. And so, you know, from there, given what I read and studied and observed in Scottsboro, Alabama, as well as what I began to see unfold in New York, you know, I knew that just based on history, you know, if you don't know anything else, that this was extremely serious and these people were playing for keeps, because there you have, again, those who failed to learn from the lessons of history are condemned to repeat them. So, you know, and it was obvious to me that just like the Scottsboro boys themselves were mostly all convicted, and that this was going to happen again. And so, you know, the outcome seemed to have been pretty certain. Now, the question became, in my mind, was how do you examine the rules of engagement? And that's something else very important. Because, you see, rules of engagement is like principles of warfare. And you got to be able to study these rules and understand how you can make them work in your behalf. People don't realize that, you know, when you begin to engage in the rules of engagement, you got to manipulate certain rules. So I looked at it and I said, well, you know, what I have to do, one, is to conduct a preemptive strike, which means that I have to, you know, catch them off balance and then make a certain announcement right from there. So when I went in the courtroom on the date of the arraignment, the preemptive strike that I recognized was necessary for me was to simply announce right then and there that I'm also ready. And what that meant was it invoked the speedy trial rules, because the speedy trial rules don't begin to tick until somebody says, I'm immediately ready to go to trial. Normally, the only person that ever says that is the prosecutor. So, you know, and so when I got there this particular date, you know, the other lawyers were saying, well, let me have more time. I want to study. I want to do this and that. And when I showed up, I said, look, I want 12 in the box right now. You know, I'm ready to go. I'm not waiting for nothing. I don't need no discovery. I don't need no time. I don't need nothing. I want 12 in the box. So, you know, the reaction of the prosecutor, well, he don't know what he's doing. You know, and I said, well, let me worry about that. You know, if I don't know what I'm doing, I mean, you know, obviously somebody thought that I did know. I mean, I did get a notice that I passed the bar exam, you know. I mean, and I fit all the other criteria. So, you know, I must know something. And we'll find out whether we can really back that up when we go to trial. And so, you know, we had to go through that. But they understood what I was doing was invoking the speedy trial rules and getting the clock to tick immediately, which is what prosecutors cannot handle. They cannot handle the clock ticking immediately, and they want lawyers to accommodate what they are trying to do. And I just simply said, I realize I can't do that to Briscoe. The only way I'm going to get out of this is to do what I'm doing, because you got to understand, you have pretrial publicity going on. And this was very negative pretrial publicity. So now you got a jury pool of prospective jurors who are every evening at 6 o'clock looking at 6 o'clock news and looking at these boys say, I'm guilty. Now, over a period of time, it has to have some kind of cumulative negative effect on the minds of prospective jurors. And I don't care how much you have a conversation with them about whether they can be fair or not. They can't erase from their minds the fact that they looked and saw these young boys saying that I'm guilty and begin to provide all kinds of details and look at their parents and everybody sitting next to them. And so, you know, given all of that, I said, well, look, this is the only thing I can do, because we can't beat this no other way. They're not stopping the pretrial publicity. The Fourth Estate has gone crazy, you know, in brainwashing prospective jurors. And so, you know, and I know that Gallagher, who is the judge here, who was appointed out of box, because here you have the judge who is not even elected by the people of Manhattan. This judge was elected by the people of the Bronx. So why is somebody who is not elected by the people of Manhattan sitting over trial in Manhattan involving the Manhattan Supreme Court? And so, to me, that's the fact of a kangaroo proceeding. And so I just simply said, given all of these various circumstances and others, that this is what our strategy is, and we got to live with it.
Well, you demanded an immediate trial, which shakes up the prosecution. But this also is part instinct, isn't it? As a seasoned trial attorney, you know that there were already hints in play to suggest that this was going to be a mass railroading. And how did it evidence itself once you announced that you are ready for a trial? Immediately put 12 jurors in the box and let's get on with this trial.
Well, you're absolutely correct. I mean, first of all, you go back and what you say, which is operative, and that is you have to have some instincts here, and you have to be able to look at what a prosecutor has to do in building a case. I mean, because you have to basically not only know your side, but you have to know the prosecutor's side, and you have to reason that this prosecutor or the prosecutor's office involving 7 defendants and accumulating a lot of trial evidence or lack of evidence and dealing with the various other law enforcement agencies is not going to be able to do this in 6 months. And so, you know, that was what was embarking on my mind, that there was just no way that when you look at this trial, you could believe that this prosecutor's office is going to be able to do that. And I also knew that the prosecutor's office did not want to try my kind separately from the others, because that would have given the others advance notice of their case. And so, you know, given the fact that, you know, I was basically pushing them up against the wall, you know, they had no other choice than to decide, well, it's better for us to get 6 of them and rather than try to go for the whole hog.
Shouldn't this have sent off a major alarm among the other attorneys to say, well, wait a minute. If, in fact, the prosecution believes that all these clients of ours are in some way linked to this horrific crime, why would they back off on Briscoe as opposed to the other 6?
Well, I think the problem was that you have a lot of the lawyers who were actually afraid of Justice Gallagher. I mean, to be very honest with you, this man was as mean as a rattlesnake. And you had lawyers who were afraid to really challenge him on anything. I mean, to raise any issue at all. He would snap right back at them. And so now the question becomes, I mean, can I get out of this alive, or can I get out of this with a lawyer's license? And so, you know, the lawyers have to recognize that self-preservation now is the first law of nature. And so, you know, they have to go for it in that manner. Now, the reality with me is that, and this is why I always say that I'm not encouraged to ever try cases, because, you see, I don't never use self-preservation as a yardstick, and so, or to say, well, you know, I better be sort of cool in this case, because if I don't, I'll lose my meal ticket. I won't be able to pay for how to live or how to do those things that are necessary to be livable. And so, you know, that was the real difference. I mean, you have to decide, look, you know, you just got to go for it. And that's what I don't think a lot of people in the community understand, is that you asking someone to really, you know, go up against the wall, look at a firing squad, you know, and face it, and then come out, you know, with all your toes and all your eyes and all your faculties still intact.
Let's talk about how judicial misconduct, police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct evidenced themselves in the course of this trial.
Well, I tell you, the way it does, and you see, the first thing I did, and this is very important, I filed a writ of prohibition against Judge Gallagher. You know,
what is that?
Well, basically it means that this judge is acting in excess of his authority. And what I pointed out was, is that there's a regular statutory procedure for judges to be appointed to cases. And first of all, the judges who are in Manhattan should have the first bite at the apple. I mean, so, you know, it's not like, you know, this is one of those small counties and you only got one judge and now he's on vacation or whatever and you got to go hunting for another judge. I mean, you got, you know, scores of judges in Manhattan. So my point, first thing I raised, well, why are you sitting here? Because we got a whole bunch of other judges before we get to you. And so, you know, I want to examine this whole process of why you're here and the reason for your being here. And so, you know, as a result of that, you know, I really got off on a bad foot. Not that I cared, but, you know, nobody else was willing to challenge that. And so the other lawyer just simply sat there, which should have been the first thing, because lawyers have to realize that these prosecutors set the table. You know, it's just like going to a restaurant. The table is already set, you know, and you make an order from a menu that they have written from. And you got to realize that that is something that is stacked against everybody. And so when the lawyers refuse to join me in that particular Article 78 proceeding, you know, pretty much I felt like, you know, the cast was already set for the rest of the young men, and they really had no chance because the lawyers, you know, for whatever reason, I'm not castigating them. You know, and I don't know what their circumstances were. But I realized that they were not getting ready to lose their law license for the sake of advancing justice.
I noted that you're the only attorney in this whole group that offered services pro bono. Mm-hmm. Is there something significant about that?
Well, I tell you, one thing that was, and this is another thing, and you said a moment ago when you were talking about a private attorney general. When I started practicing law, what I realized is that the legal system was so stacked against people that the black community really needed lawyers that they were supporting who could really have their interests at heart and rather than to be just a private attorney. You know, and the most people show up in a courtroom as a private attorney representing a defendant in a public matter, and that just doesn't add up. And so, you know, usually the reason why I had to continue to donate my services was because of the fact that I realized that, you know, that's not a level playing field, and that the only way that you can actually grant some guarantee of justice or modicum of justice were to actually just show up and say, look, I'm not taking a dime, you know, and whatever got to happen, you know, and that's what has to happen. Now, the other side, which is something that a lot of people may not know in terms of my career in the legal profession, is that there were times when I was able to get a court to say that the court would pay some of my legal expenses. However, I can certainly say that never, ever in the history of my practice of law have I ever taken a dime from the public. So, you know, the money that I could have gotten, say, $25,000, $40,000, or $50,000 for particular cases, I never took that money. So, you know, but nobody credited me with that later. Nobody said, well, you know, this man really saved the state of New York a lot of money or the city of New York a lot of money. But the reality of it is that the record reflects that I've never taken any money, and that when I said I was doing it for nothing, that's just exactly what I meant.
Well, we have this interesting difficulty here, and it seems to me there's a very uncomfortable feeling that, in a way, In the middle of all of this discussion about the $40 million settlement and the overturning of their convictions and so forth, lost in the sauce is the grave matter of prosecutorial, judicial, and law enforcement misconduct. And
absolutely.
Who is addressing that? Where did that go?
Well, you know, and you're absolutely right, because, you know, like I said before, the first thing I think what should have happened in this case, in my opinion, was should have been a class action lawsuit, because there are many other grieved persons in Harlem or the environs of Harlem that were affected. And those persons should have had an opportunity to have their day in court. They should still have their day in court, but they were not. The other thing that I think that should have happened is that the lawyers should have asked for a special referee to actually look into the question of whether there was misconduct in this case and what led to these wrongful convictions, because that's the only way that you can do some modicum of justice rather than just taking hush money, which seems like was all that people were interested in, is getting this hush money and running, because that's what has happened. So there has been no inspection of what this prosecutorial misconduct was and how it has really affected these young men and how it can be avoided in the future.
And it also has to deal with this matter of reform. I mean, it's a very popular word. People like
right.
the idea of criminal justice reform. And here, at the root of it, is a kind of conglomeration of all kinds of things that historically have been wrong about the criminal justice system that inordinately impact communities of color. We're talking here about false arrest.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking here about the manufacturing of evidence despite the impetus to make sure that other things were excluded. They were buckling under the pressure of a racist administration demanding that this case be solved. Corners were cut. Police officers employed extraordinary measures in order to obtain suspects and in order to hand over to the prosecutors whatever it is they consider as evidence that would result in a surefire conviction of these young men. We have the inordinate, a kind of conspiracy in a sense, because everybody was under the pressure to deliver convictions in this case. But we have had, at the end of the trial, we have these young men going to prison, some for terms of 7 years and up to 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, just the same, the police officers and the detectives involved moving on with their careers, in some cases getting promotions.
Right.
We have the prosecutor going on to a wonderful, lucrative afterlife and being able to write books and papers and enjoy a certain stature within that community. And life goes on for them. So where is the reform here? Where is the discussion as to what is owed on that level, not just pertaining to the particular case, but for future cases?
Well, and you ask a very important issue, and one which I'm trying to acquaint our people in the community with. Because, you see, one thing that we have to understand, that for every wrong, there is a right. That's very important. So if there's a wrong, we got to find a right to supplement, you know, what has really happened. And so in this particular case, it would seem to me, and this is something that can be done very well, it would seem to me that Governor Andrew Cuomo would impanel a special grand jury and a special prosecutor to look at this case and to warn if anybody is subject to any kind of criminal liability, action will be taken against that person or persons. And secondly, in addition to that particular issue, there will be legislative recommendations. How do we improve this? How do we make sure that this never happened again? So, you know, you have a situation where basically now, and this is one of the problems that I'm really bringing up, in addition to Tawana Brawley, it seems as though I'm the only one that may have any knowledge of the law. I mean, because you got all these black selected officials, you got all these leading blacks, and all these other folks who have said zero. I mean, so, you know, well, where does our representation come from? And so, you know, if we all going to sit by and act like we're going to accommodate Cuomo and help him get reelected again and forget about our own young people and the potential harm that others may suffer, you know, this is a serious problem. This is why, you know, as I said before, I really don't want to go back to the practice of law. I just don't, because it's just too much that, you know, is imposed upon somebody. But obviously, you know, there is nobody out there. I mean, you know, just pick up the phone today. Call your black selected official and say, what are you saying about the Central Park 7? Call your leading blacks and what are you saying about the Central Park 7? Or call people at radio stations and say, why are you practicing censorship? Why can't we really have a full discussion on this issue? Call Channel 7, Channel 4, and others and say, why can't we have public affairs programming around this subject to make sure that this never happened again? So there's a million things that have to be done, and, you know, hopefully, you know, we can begin to address that tomorrow night. But just simply to take the money and wrong would be a grave injustice to those generations that are yet unborn.
Well, you know, I couldn't help but chuckle when you talked about Governor Andrew Cuomo empaneling, getting a special prosecutor to take a look at this case, because I remember you were principally responsible for forcing his father to appoint a special prosecutor in cases in New York. That is not likely to happen because could you recall for us the battle to get Mario Cuomo to appoint a special prosecutor in the Howard Beach case?
Well, you know, and the problem is that unfortunately, most of the black leaders in our community were against it. I mean, you know, at least they were telling him they were against it. And so, you know, and people were saying that I was crazy, that I was trying to mess up the criminal justice system, you know, that I was a real problem that needed to be addressed. So, you know, the question became, how do you exercise leverage under those circumstances? And, you know, that's basically what we did, because we did have some leverage. I mean, we had some political capital, and we had some leverage in order to exercise that political capital, and it ended up bringing about some of those changes. But now the question becomes, every time that you do that, you become a targeted figure. You know, and so at some point, they're going to say, wait a minute, let's get rid of this guy. We don't need him. Let's go back to enjoying our lives, enjoying ourselves. Because these white elected officials are there to maintain white supremacy. I mean, just simple as that. So, you know, for us to be sitting around thinking that these folks are getting ready to do right, is absolutely nonsense, because they want to maintain the status quo. They don't want any problem. They don't want to hear any noise. They want everybody to go along and get along. And so, you know, and so you're absolutely right. It is not easy, but it's the only thing that you can do now. And we have to push these folks to do the things that are necessary, that our children who will be out in the streets day and night would not be subjected to these kinds of abuses in the future.
But we have one prominent person, Reverend Al Sharpton, who basically has endorsed this settlement, praised Mayor de Blasio, and praised the whole process, saying this is what justice looks like.
Yeah, well, you see, well, let me say this to the audience. I plan to go back into practice of law, but my first opponent is going to be Al Sharpton. I mean, let's make it clear. Al Sharpton is going to do everything conceivable to make sure that I don't ever get an opportunity to represent another person again, never get an opportunity to have another payday, never have an opportunity to travel freely and do all those things. I mean, that's just point simple. And the reason is, Reverend Sharpton is the right hand of Andrew Cuomo. He meets with him daily. And so everything that Cuomo wants, it has to be approved through Sharpton, and then it has to be approved through David Patterson, who is head of the New York State Democratic Committee. So our people got to understand that it's not going to be easy, you know, and Sharpton is going to call for my head if he can get it. So that's the reason why I said that, you know, but what other alternative do we have now? I mean, we don't have no other lawyers out here. Let's get out there. If we have some other lawyers, why don't they show up? Why don't they say something? Why don't you call them and ask them, will you please open your mouth? But we don't have that. So, you know, there are many options that we have, but we have to have lawyers who know how to put those options in place, and lawyers who respect the teachings of Charles Hamilton Houston, who said that any black lawyer who is not a social engineer is a social parasite. Those are the words Charles Hamilton Houston. I didn't say that. Charles Hamilton Houston said that. You know, and so, and he's the one that set the high bar for us as lawyers to have to meet. And so, you know, and like I said before, it's not something I want to do, but it's something seemingly I don't have no other alternative, because you got a young girl, Tawana Brawley, who's been raped by Stephen Pagonis and others, and she's down there unemployed with no money at all, and only her helping hand she can call is mine. And I'm up here unemployed too. So you can imagine what kind of situation that is, where you have two people who are totally unemployed, and then you have a child who is a victim caught in the middle.
Well, you know, we are going to be continuing this discussion tomorrow, but could you set the stage for what we should be focusing on tomorrow, some of the things that you will be touching on tomorrow? I know what I would want to ask you, but from your perspective, what are the primary things that we ought to understand from this case and that you continue tomorrow?
You know, one thing, and you know, you've been knowing me long enough to know this, when you call me, I always tell you, Trees, just start asking questions. It don't make no difference what the issue is.
I know.
What the area is, you know what I mean? Because I know that you are a very adept at being a questioner, and so, you know, if you realize that there are no hard questions for me, that whatever you ask, I'm going to answer, and I'm going to give you my best shot at an answer, you know, then everything going to work out all right. And so that's where I would like to continue. Just, you know, for you to go home and do the homework and ask me the hard questions, and I'll give you the easy answers.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Alton, for this orientation today that already has raised some very critical issues that have not, incidentally, popped up anywhere else. I have not heard it discussed on air. I have not seen it in print.
And that's the problem with censorship. That's why people got to understand. Censorship is a dangerous concept. It was started on the plantation. It still is thriving today, and we have to address it.
So this begins a very interesting discussion using this case, because there's so many reasons that this case is vitally important for people to understand, not only in New York City, because this is a universal issue here. It is it is of importance no matter where you are geographically, because elements of this basically are composites of the universal story about the relationship between citizens and the apparatus of government, and more specifically about the role of the criminal justice system in our lives, especially in the lives of oppressed communities. And we have the matter of, you know, politics, the politics of expediency. It makes sense to make a grand statement of generosity and a suggestion of a will to make amends for injustice, but there still is injustice. And there is injustice even in this situation that purports to be about rectifying an injustice. So thanks
correct.
So much for being with us today, Alton. We'll see you again tomorrow, and we continue the discussion then.
Thank you very much, Yutrice.
Thanks a lot. I want to thank you very much for joining me today, and I hope that this discussion begins to open our eyes and ears about things. I always say that things are very seldom as they seem. There are always some things that you have to look out for and read between the lines. I want to thank also the Buffalo Bullet, my friend Chris Stevens, for helping us get an understanding many of his programs on air, the Buffalo Bullet, you should check that out, also have been addressing these issues with Alton Maddox. And the reference is, of course, that it is in the non-mainstream press and media that these discussions are occurring. And even so, there are limitations even there. So we are very fortunate to have PRN to be able to discuss these matters in ways that are frank and open, and people can easily understand why these issues are resonating so deeply in some communities, when in other communities, it's no big deal. This is the story of our life in the United States. It's a racially bifurcated world. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. Send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. I want to thank you so much for being with me today. Pass the word about this program and certainly about tomorrow's continuation. And thank you for the pleasure and the privilege of your company. Bye-bye.